Comic books have long told stories, but these stories have been of masked men in tights and capes, fighting for justice using their superhuman strength, or, in the case of Batman, rigorous training and a keen intellect. But these stories are works of fantasy, meant to entertain, not enlighten. In recent years, however, artists and writers have found the combination of words and drawings a powerful way to tell compelling stories, and the form of the graphic novel, an extended comic book, has gained acceptability as a literary form. In 1992, Art Spiegelman won a Pulitzer Prize with his graphic novel, Mouse, A Survivor's Tale. Mouse tells the story of Spiegelman's father's experience during the Holocaust. In the winter of 2008, one class at Stanford set out to collaboratively produce their very own full-length graphic novel, a work that would tell a true story of first love, corruption, violence, and karaoke. Along the way, they discovered how serious comics could be and how hard it is to depict someone else's life. In our first piece of the show, Dan Hirsch tells their story.
Creative writing instructors Tom Keeley and Adam Johnson wanted to make a full-length graphic novel with their class of 15 students. They hoped to explore the medium and work collaboratively, but mostly, they wanted to tell a good story. This was not so easy a task. First, they had to get 15 people to agree on which story to tell. And when they did all agree, it was the true story of someone else's life. In the weeks of their class, they had to find a delicate balance between telling a good story and telling the truth. In the end, both students and instructors had to wonder if they had done literary justice to their character, a real woman, and whether or not they had made the right choices in telling someone else's story.
She got shot in the shoulder, but this is just a close-up of her punching her stomach. And then here would be, this is like 2:30 a.m.
Yeah.
This is an aerial view of the whole scene, so like panicked-like people who saw it or ran in when they heard the gunshot. Her lying on her back, and then the niece clutching her stomach. And that's all I got done.
Sweet.
Okay. I submitted a bunch of drawings to Eric, who is the reporter who kind of like presented us with the story of Top Marina, and he told me that in Cambodia there are no sidewalks. I'd drawn a lot of sidewalks, so I don't really know how I'm going to deal with this problem, except for maybe pretend I never heard him say that there are no sidewalks. So that's why I left.
Just that,
but, I was looking at images on Google of gunshot victims and like people in the process of being shot, and my friend was there, and he was like, "What are you doing?"
These are the voices of Tom Keeley and Adam Johnson's graphic novel class as they worked throughout the quarter. Over the course of 10 weeks, the class met for over 9 hours a week in both the afternoon and evenings. Their class would often be filled with photographs posted on the wall, pizza boxes in the corner, and tables crowded with ink drawings, art supplies, and laptops. The class consisted of 15 students, both artists and writers, collaborating together to produce one final product, a full-length graphic novel. Here are instructors Tom and Adam discussing their initial hopes for the class.
We had taught a class called New Media Writing, where we looked at anything involving the internet and the writer. We did look at graphic novels as well, because there's just a lot of e-comics on the web, and that's where a lot of the students gravitated towards. And coming out of that class, which we taught a year ago, Adam, I mean, this is really your idea. You just dug the graphic novel, and you were like, and we're going to make a book. You know, and I was like, well, that sounds good. You know, what are we going to make? You know, like a 50-page book or something? Are we going to make like a collection of short stories, you know, short comics and stuff? And Adam was like, we are going to make a book, a full-on book, and it's going to look great.
I think if ever once we would have wavered, it wouldn't have happened.
That's right.
People kept saying, you're going to do what? You're going to make a book?
Yes.
With that many students?
Yeah.
In a few weeks?
Yeah.
I would have to say absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I... saying it enough, I think we've started to believe it. And when the class came close to starting up, I suddenly felt a tremendous amount of pressure, like, holy shit, it's real.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. It was the hardest class I've ever been part of, even including the first class I ever taught.
When the class began, things started out well. Tom and Adam had gathered a good mix of students with both drawing and writing skills. They spent the first 4 weeks reading and discussing various graphic novels and working on small exercises to hone their storytelling skills, experiment with the form, and learn to work together. By week four, it was time to get started on what would be the final product. A graphic novel written and illustrated by 15 different Stanford students. But choosing a story to adapt into a graphic novel that everyone could be happy with was an incredible challenge that almost brought their collaborative process to a near standstill for days. This is Jessica Johnson,
definitely,
a senior in the class.
Especially when deciding on a topic. There was one day there that we actually skipped our break on a Monday, so it went from like 3 to 8, and we were just talking about which subject we'd choose. And we wanted everyone to be happy with it. Everyone was just so frustrated and tired, and they just almost wanted to be told what to do.
This is Adam, discussing the process of picking a story with various students.
It truly felt like in the name of collaboration, we had disenfranchised everyone in the class. That was a little low. I mean, I went home and I talked to my wife for a long time about that.
I actually almost cried because I was so frustrated with the topic picking.
You were?
Yeah.
You almost cried.
I almost cried.
I was so tired by the end of that day. Like, when you walked out at 9, we didn't even have a topic. And, like, I think there were a couple of us on the stairs just going, like, that was the most painful experience of my life.
It totally was.
But then things changed. One member of the class, Nightfellow Eric Pape, realized that he had the perfect story for adaptation from his career as a journalist.
Well, I've been a journalist for well over a decade. I was living in New York City at the time. At the time, I was a freelance writer and who had lived in Cambodia for several years, worked extensively in Cambodia as a reporter. And basically, I read the story from the wire services soon after. The girl in the story, Tat Marina, was attacked. And then I found out that the girl eventually made it to Boston, where she was being treated for her medical care.
The girl Eric went to visit in Boston was a young woman from Cambodia named Tat Marina. As a young girl, Tat Marina sold shakes on the street to support her family in Phnom Penh. But eventually, attracted by higher wages and a more glamorous life, she moved into work as a karaoke singer at one of Phnom Penh's many karaoke clubs, where she eventually reached a sort of stardom performing in music videos. It was there her beauty and youth attracted the attentions of an older man, a powerful government administrator.
It's really a story that is more universal than I realized at the time. It's a teenage girl's story of first love, but one that went horribly wrong. This is a poor girl who met a wealthy, powerful man. And when I say poor, I'm talking Cambodian middle class, which means, you know, middle class in Cambodia basically means you own a blender or you own a moped because then you have a source of revenue, which means in American terms we're talking dirt poor. She met a very wealthy, powerful man who was a prominent official in the government. He basically lured her into a relationship, began to financially support her and create dependencies, and basically when she tried to get out of the relationship after she found out that he was married, he imprisoned her, basically, and said, "You can't leave me." After a certain amount of time, she accepted to stay with him because she was afraid he would become more abusive in a sense. I don't know that he actually ever hit her. I think that he didn't, from what I know. But he did do some terrible things. And then she decided that she would stay with him. He ultimately tried to protect her and care for her, but some other people ended up attacking her out of jealousy, basically on the orders of his wife. And it was a horrible attack, which is what sent her to the U.S.
In a crowded market, Marina was attacked with acid that left her horribly disfigured and maimed. She is one of many women in Cambodia who have been attacked in this way, and whose attackers have yet to be prosecuted. When Eric met Marina for the interview, she was living with her half-brother in Boston, where she hoped to receive plastic surgery to restore her appearance. Eric, along with another journalist, attempted to publish Marina's story in various American periodicals, but were turned down numerous times. Finally, one set of editors agreed to publish their story, but that was the week before the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001.
We were preparing a big story for an American audience, but after 9/11, no one cared. So we wondered, what do we do with this material? nothing's going to happen in the U.S. now because of it. So we wanted to take it to Cambodia, and then we thought a graphic novel would be a wonderful way to do that. We thought if we created a little booklet with drawings that were almost cartoonish, it would look harmless, so the authorities wouldn't figure out it was something kind of subversive in a way. So that was in our mind. The problem is we had no idea how to do graphic novels and how to find the people to transfer it. So when I came here on a John S. Knight fellowship and I heard about this class, I thought, hey, this is my chance to get more familiar with this world.
Out of there that day. And I mean all the students, the people who were arguing each way were just like, what have we gotten ourselves into? We're never going to get going. And then, of course, Eric came in with the story that he had told to me about Top Marine, about this person who had been burned with acid. And he sort of told me the story the day before. And I turned to him in class without any – I don't remember us having that as the game plan. I think I went in there and was so frustrated from the previous class. I just turned to the journalist in our class and said, hey, would you tell a story because I don't feel like talking right now.
I said that, and I ran through the story in about 10 minutes. And one of the goals of this course was to do some sort of good. And I also emphasized that no justice was ever – obtained in this case, and it's very unlikely, unless there's a change of government in Cambodia, that the people who attacked Marina will be held responsible. And I think that that, along with other elements in the story, the sort of first love elements I mentioned before, of a teenager connected with a lot of the class.
And he told the story, and then he had to go. He had a meeting to go to, and he left the room. And I think we were about to change the subject, and instead one of the students, like Jessica, was like, I like that idea. You know, can we talk about it? And they talked about it for 15 minutes, and everybody said yes, and we were rolling.
It was electric.
It was electric. It really was.
And then I left, and then I got a call back from Tom, and he said he had never seen anything like it after I left. The students unanimously said that they were really passionate about the story.
This is Junior, Sarah Sisson, one of the class's illustrators.
I'm really excited that we finally ended up with that topic, because I think it's something that actually is like a compelling story and that everyone cared about. But what I found like really compelling was kind of her story as being like a normal 15-year-old girl who wanted to appear attractive and wanted to perform in a karaoke bar, and kind of like how that would appeal to a reader in the United States, like a high school reader. And it kind of like universalizes, like there you can draw connections between yourself and this girl in Cambodia, and then you realize like what she went through, and you can really empathize with the characters.
Here's Jessica Johnson.
And all of a sudden, Eric, the reporter in our class, came in and he proposed this story that he had heard. Really hearing it from him, it gave a true story that had humanity in it, that had all the things that people were looking for, and we were like, hey, here's a thing we can like make a difference, here's a story we can tell. And it was just a really great moment for the whole class to be able to say, hey, we have an idea, we're going somewhere, we're making progress.
So this was a young woman with no advocate. This was a story with no just resolution, and it was a story that the world had conspired to prevent its telling in some strange way. And they picked up that cause.
Yeah, the justice element was big, that people had attacked her and they were walking around scot-free, and that didn't seem right.
I'm a little intimidated by how much work we have left to do.
Deciding to base their graphic novel on the life of Top Marina was certainly a high point in the class's collaborative process. Everyone seemed enthusiastic to get to work, but after the initial excitement of choosing the story, it became obvious that the difficult decision-making was not over, and they had to face a whole new set of problems. They had to ask themselves, what is the best way to tell this story? This is Tom Keeley on February 11th.
So yeah, so today we have our story, but we're brainstorming about what scenes we're going to draw, what panels we're going to draw. I'm looking up at the board right now. There's one about she used to serve milkshakes in this bazaar. We're not rejecting any ideas. We're just accepting every idea, and we're going to put it up on the board and try to come up with a structure for it.
The whiteboards in their classroom in Wallenberg Hall were completely filled with various ideas for panels. Every inch of board was covered in suggestions. Throughout the class, Adam and Tom kept adding more as they arose, searching for space in the already crowded board. The students split up to share their individual proposals for the breakdown of the story into acts.
But for one group, even the discussion of whether or not to frame the story using flashbacks became a somewhat heated debate.
Think of how many movies like start with a murderer, and then you know you have to go back and figure out how the murder happened.
But the ones that do are good.
I thought the point of the story was her like psychological growth, though, not like, oh, an acid attack, how'd that happen? Not like a murder story.
Well, that's, I mean, that's the basic fact of the book. I mean, we're not aiming for a detailed autobiography of her, are we? I mean, we're aiming for like an explanation of this one cultural phenomenon that happened to happen.
Yeah, and what can she do? It was interesting in its own right, and it was like giving her a voice.
I guess what is the point of the story?
Deciding on narrative devices revealed a conflict about their basic conceptions of what Tot Marina's story is all about. They went on debating when in their narrative arc they should place the climactic event of the acid attack. Various students, including Lauren O'Neill and Christina Bautista, debated the use of flashbacks.
Let's put it at the beginning. No, but if you put it at the beginning, you're like, how would this happen? I want to know how it happened.
Maybe they wouldn't care. Immediately, you know, it's not like you're taking all the mystery out of it. You're actually adding to the
like how to the tension.
I don't know.
It's kind of exploitative.
Every work of art is exploitative, I feel like. Literature is exploitative, film is exploitative.
I think we can fold the story together beautifully and then be like, you see, this is where she was, this is what's happening, what's going to happen with her, and it builds and builds, and that he's already...
Oh, I can't wait to see all these now. I'm so excited.
Act 1 is here.
It's Monday night, February 18th, a week later. Even though it's a school holiday, the majority of the class has come in with their homework assignment from the weekend. Several pages of sketches of storyboards for potential novel panels. Today, they have taped all their sketches to the walls and go about the room reading their classmates' storyboard proposals. Here's Jessica Johnson.
I've been having a hard time, I guess, visualizing the whole thing, so having the storyboards really helping me to get a sense of what we need to do.
So what are we looking at right now?
This is the end sequence that I was just told is very depressing, so I went over to see what's happening right now. Basically, Marina is talking to her brother, Secundo, and a reporter. It just looks at the end that no one really understands why. She wants to go back to being a karaoke star because she thinks she'll be beautiful again someday. And it's kind of... sad because it just ends with her brother.
Even in these preliminary sketches, the students discover that they experience some discomfort and uncertainty when depicting the emotional weight of Tot Marina's story. They're telling a story from a foreign culture and have to efficiently incorporate Cambodia's dark history into their panels. They want to include a brief section about the Khmer Rouge, in which throughout the 1970s and 80s, the military regime in power killed millions of Cambodians in a brutal genocide. This is Austin Zumbro and Justine Lai explaining their storyboard sketches to Tom Keeley.
Walking down the road, and then we pull out even further and see Market, and then somehow transition to same Market, but during Khmer Rouge Revolution.
But we really need to capture that time period in a few frames right there, okay, no matter how we do it. Okay.
And then that allows us to talk about the Khmer Rouge Revolution.
Okay.
And how that changed things.
It's a montage of marching and kind of images from that were used in newspapers or things that we can find on the internet. Sort of scene of violence and then like skulls and...
Okay.
As the class goes around the room looking at each other's ideas, it also becomes clear that many are still in disagreement about the basic layout of the story. Some storyboards use the framing devices of flashbacks, switching back and forth between scenes of Marina's life in Cambodia and scenes in the U.S. after she's been attacked. When they come together as a group to discuss, it's clear that some serious decisions have to be made about their novel structure, the narrative voice, and tone.
Backstory. I almost don't want to have this section where someone's turning to me and say, this is why this story is important. I don't feel like someone should have to prove that to me. I feel like the story should just be important as it is, and I want to see this colorful marketplace with the UN, with different...
At one point, Lauren O'Neill suggests that the narrative could be framed by a graphic novelist interviewing Marina rather than a journalist, which raises a question about the potential truth claims of their novel.
You know, you see those every so often where it's like...
Yeah.
It's like,
you know, and this book is what he wrote, or, you know, like.
Does that create an impression that this is truthful then? That, like, we sat down with her and that...
Maybe.
Well,
there's a weird pattern.
In a way, we did.
There's a weird pattern in this story of taking away her voice and taking away her choices.
Yeah, but, yeah, I totally agree with Dana. It's like we want... Marina's voice is what we want to bring through. If we do nothing else, I want her voice to be present in this story. I don't care how bad we succeed or fail or what have you. That's the voice that I want.
Again, and once the penciling gets a certain distance, the inking will come behind it. It'll be a horse race. Once the inking starts going in, the scanning, lettering.
Cool. All right.
So that made Tom weirdly optimistic. deeply fearful.
Last questions, comments?
Thanks for coming in today. I know it was your vacation.
To grab their attention. That's why we have a great opening line. Our opening line is, the best place for a milkshake cart in Cambodia is outside the torture museum. And, you know, it's this weird, odd, you know, line. And I think it does grab people's attention. I'm sure some people will pick up the book and say, I don't want anything to do with this whatsoever. But in any case, you're right. Hopefully, I think Act 5 will be better, but I wish it was a little bit more evened out.
Well, I mean, no, I'm sure. And, like, I don't think it's going to be that.
It's March 3rd, 2 weeks later. This is Tom with Austin Zumbro discussing how the class is doing only 2 weeks before their end-of-quarter deadline. They are hurriedly walking to the Stanford bookstore to pick up more pens for the illustrators. The bells in the background are from the Stanford clock tower. And for the graphic novel class, it's definitely crunch time.
So yeah, so we've basically spent 2 weeks doing one-fifth of the book, and we have 2 weeks to do the other four-fifths. But I think that we figured out processes, and I think we figured out personalities, and the team seemed to be working really well. So I don't know if I have much of a reputation, but I will bet my reputation that we'll be done by Wednesday the 19th.
They have about 2 weeks to produce over 200 pages.
Throughout this process, on week 8, we're like, I know what we should have done in week 2. So it's great. Right now, Austin and I have the best job at the moment. That means we get to get out of the chaos that is that classroom and go shopping for pens. So we're looking for a pilot. We're looking for many. Yeah. Pilot V5s. And
so here's Pilot G2. That's not what we want. Have we bought them here before?
No.
Oh.
How much bubble space around the words? Because, like, you know, sometimes you have a lot of space around, like, the lines. And sometimes
back at the classroom, it's a whirlwind of activity with the room divided into groups. Illustrators working on one side of the room, writers on the other, and a layout team making up blank panels. In the last 2 weeks, the class has made large decisions about their story. They decided to drop the flashback structure for a more linear one, have chosen to write the narration in the first person, and have planned out each of the acts. The first act has been completely illustrated and inked, but currently the illustrators are waiting for more script from the writers, who seem to be stalling on subsequent acts. Specific scenes pose unique challenges for the writers. Tonight, they are visited by professional graphic novelist Andy Hartzell, who works with Lauren O'Neill on writing the script for one particularly problematic scene.
We are working on the Act 3 of... what's the name of this book?
We don't have a name yet.
This graphic novel, the end of Act 3, kind of climactic sequence.
Cool.
Well, the big problem we're working through is how to depict the deflowering of a 15-year-old girl at the hands of an older man in a way that is, you know, not vulgar.
Tasteful.
Or crude, something that is tasteful, that is true to the psychologies of the character. That's the big problem that we...
Sounds like a
kind of a big problem, right?
On their way back from the bookstore, Tom and Austin discuss the challenges of depicting a true story and the sensitive nature of that story. As they get closer to completing their book and presenting a finished product to the world, they are faced with broader questions about the possible implications of telling Marina's story.
And the question came up, does Marina want this attention? anymore. And one thing that helped us feel better about it is Eric Pape, who's the journalist who covered her to begin with, has pointed out that she's part of this video about acid burnings that's about to come out. So I don't know if she wants to be in the spotlight, but she wants to hear her story heard. Yeah, wants to have her story heard. And so I feel like in this last week, and probably as late as spring break, we'll have Eric talking with her. We'll have other people, you know, getting her take on it, her brother's take. One change that we've made is we're not including names. Right now, she's just known as Shake Girl. She makes shakes in the market. In some ways, it's creative nonfiction, so we're taking the facts of her life and then imagining. I think that there's some apprehension about that, and I think towards the last week, there'll be four or five people from this class sitting around the table and saying, what do we have to do to make ourselves feel comfortable about this? Because if there's one thing that everyone has in common in this class, we're all excited about the story, and we all care a lot about her, and we want her to be... to feel positive about whatever product we put out.
I think you develop sort of an acute sensitivity to it, just like researching pictures. All the pictures you find online are all of American tourists with these girls. Like, you never, there's no information out there just about the girls. It's always like American college kids having a party, and you sort of see them in the background serving drinks, and there's always that dynamic. And then I think, I mean...
Tom and Austin re-enter Wallenberg Hall to deliver a packet of whiteout and several varieties of black ink pens to the busily working room of students. They continue another long night in what will be a string of long nights as they make the final push to finish their graphic novel.
So we should talk at 8:30-ish. Okay. And just check in.
But things did not go so smoothly. In the final push to finish their project, Tom and Adam ran into a surprising new problem when they chose to meet with a team of Stanford lawyers.
We were asked if we would speak with the Stanford lawyers because this is going to be something that's going to be printed and people are going to see it. And it does, its source is from the real world. I remember coming back to the office one day and Adam had been on the phone with the lawyers for about, what, 2 hours?
Almost, yeah.
And I had never seen him so run over in his entire life. I mean, he looked like a truck had just hit him. A truck full of lawyers. Had a lot of questions for him. They, from my understanding, didn't know what a graphic novel was. So there's going to be some pictures involved with this. How many pictures will you have? Oh, well, about 700. Oh, wait a second. You're putting words in the characters' mouths? You're doing what? That was an interesting day. I didn't know where the status of our project was right after that.
Here's Adam discussing the conversation he had with the Stanford lawyers that threatened to terminate all their weeks of hard work.
The Stanford lawyers were very afraid that these were libelous depictions and that basically the whole cabinet of the nation of Cambodia would go into action against us. I was on a conference call, and there were many lawyers, and they were in different places. I thought that I gave a great response to a lot of their inquiries. I was a journalism major, you know, in college, and I talked about, you know, truth and fair use and cultural commentary and a lot of the classic defenses for libelous depictions. One of them had a legal answer for everything, and they just took turns rotating, beating me down and beating me down. And of course, there was something accurate to what they were saying, but it came to pass that they didn't know what a graphic novel was. I kept saying, well, you know, my students are very invested in the story, and the story's important. And one of the lawyers finally just stopped me and said, you know, there's no such thing as a story. There are only accounts that are legally defensible in a court of law. That was when I broke. That was when I said, I'm not going to get anywhere with these people.
But luckily, things changed when Tom had the idea of inviting one of the top lawyers to their class and have them see firsthand what their work really looked like.
And she came and looked at the students drawing, looked at them writing, looked at them compiling. She saw how the desktops or their laptops were covered with pictures and images, and She saw that our whiteboards were filled with ideas and that we were all engaged in an act that I think she had never witnessed before, a type of creativity that was truly pure. And afterwards, she came back from the ledge of our deaths and said, you know, there, wait a minute, you know, this is a good project. And at that point, she said, we're going to find a way to make this work.
After some more discussions and some slight moderations, the class proceeds in their work as planned, with the support of the Stanford lawyers. On March 17th, only a few days before the end of winter quarter, the class is still finishing up drawing. They are not going to make Tom's March 19th deadline, but are still in good shape to finish the graphic novel and send it to the printer within the first few weeks of spring quarter. The room is relaxed tonight, as the illustrators continue to plug away at their final drawings, the writers work on copy editing, and the layout team scans final pages into the computer. Yet, as they are so close to finishing their graphic novel, there still remains some discomfort in depicting the more gruesome aspects of this story. Here's one of the illustrators, Justine Lai, discussing her drawings.
Flashback to the history. So it's like a mini history lesson about the Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia. So it's kind of taken me a while to draw just because it's kind of an emotional topic and it's kind of a downer, like, oh, okay, pile of skulls. Okay, someone, you know, draw some famine one in one little square. You know, that kind of.
Despite some of the ethical concerns that still linger, Tom and Adam defend the choices they've made and the liberties they've taken with the story, and argue that the final product is not pure nonfiction, but rather a fictionalized account of true events.
Nonfiction stories from the real world are often messy. They don't resolve well. But it is a graphic novel, and when people come to a novel, they expect a story that has some kind of shape and satisfaction. And because there are only four or five news stories about what happened to this young woman, and stories similar. I mean, she was not alone. She was representative of the unfortunate fates of many young women in Cambodia because of this phenomenon.
Yes.
We had to conjure. We were, I think, hypersensitive to getting Cambodia as best we could, to being culturally sensitive, to writing a story that we thought our subject would approve of. And yet, we dove in and started writing in the first person. And once the illustration team agreed on the look of the character, they all sat down and drew her over and over and over. They spent hours, and their hands took on a muscle memory of her face. And as we spent night and day writing in her voice and in her dialogue, a version of her that was an intersection of the humanity of our class and the humanity of her experience came to be. And so I won't say it's true to her, but it's true to a collaboration, and maybe she was an unwilling collaborator in this artistic project, but I think it's a truthful story.
There's been a hesitancy to put words in her mouth particularly, so people didn't want to do first person, and people didn't want to do from her perspective, they want to do from her brother's perspective. So there's a lot of issues where we've kind of been trying to like hedge ourselves and say like, well, maybe if we put another layer there, then it's safer. And while that is safer, I've kind of been on the side that it won't create as good a project because we're being safe instead of trying for that one truth that we can get to.
I think she'll really like the book, you know? And we definitely went into this process with that spirit, you know? I don't know, some things we had to imagine. You know, lots of things we had to imagine. And I'm sure there's things that are inaccurate, but this wasn't our goal. Our goal was to get the spirit of the story and the spirit of who she is, as best we know, on the page.
Through the process of transforming his initial piece about Tot Marina's story into a graphic novel, journalist Eric Pape discovered that the graphic novel can do some things that more traditional, supposedly objective forms of journalism can't do.
In an article, there are certain things that I can write, but it will turn people off. And in a graphic novel, you can portray it in a way that distances, and yet you can keep the emotional attachment with the reader. We can represent her inner world. There's a scene that's entirely fictional in the story that is it's purely representational, where she's trapped as a prisoner, and she writes a note to her brother to come save her, and she folds it into an airplane and she throws it out the window because she's locked in a room. She's on the top floor of a hotel with a guard at the door. And basically, it soars through the air and it represents her hope. And soaring over Cambodia, it starts to rain and the plane starts to sink. And then it turns into a pigeon and it flies on and it's her hope. I won't tell you what happens to the bird then.
In the final weeks, Eric tried to get in touch with Tot Marina and her brother in Boston to inform them about the graphic novel. After many failed attempts and wrong numbers, he finally talked to them on the phone. Here's an excerpt from an email he sent to the Storytelling Project, describing that conversation. I spoke with both Marina and her brother recently. It was very nice. Her brother still hopes that one day there will be justice for his sister. Marina now speaks English like an American girl. She's 24. She had a sort of bookkeeping job for a little while, and she's trying to figure out what to do with her life. She is interested in potentially becoming a nurse. Overall, she is much healthier physically. She was very encouraging about the idea of a graphic novel, as well as other projects that might help other girls to avoid her fate. What you're listening to is the soundtrack of one of the videos featuring Tot Marina before she was attacked and left Cambodia to come to the United States.